Hachette Audio presents Robert Ludlum's The Born Enigma, written by Eric von Lustbader, read by Holter Graham. Denial is the first impulse of a traitor. Joseph Stalin. Prologue. Frankfurt, Germany. The moment Jason Bourne stepped into the Royal Brauweiser, the hotel staff snapped to attention. Not that they had been standing idle. Herr Hummel, the executive director, would have had their jobs. And in any case, they were too well trained. But Herr Bourne, well known to them, was a large tipper, and the staff scurried to take control of his three large, beautiful suitcases, each of which, they surmised, would have cost them 6 months' salary. Bourne, a broad-shouldered, impeccably dressed gentleman of obvious means, had been staying at the Royal Brauweiser over the past 3 or 4 months at irregular intervals. A businessman, he might be, the staff speculated, but his physique marked him as a man who knew his way around a gym. He was always affable, loquacious, a font of slightly off-color jokes that never failed to delight the bellboys, who fell all over themselves to do his bidding. No request was too menial for them. They were happy to be put under his spell. This morning, Bourne was shown up to his usual suite on the top floor, and after a special delivery platter from Herr Hummel himself, was left to his own devices. The moment he was alone, he stepped to the window that overlooked Thurn und Taxisplatz in the old town, took out his mobile, and pressed a speed dial number. A moment later, the connection made, a female voice answered.
"I'm installed," he said. "How long do I have to wait?"
"A few days only."
The voice in his ear warmed him.
"We're tracking him. He'll soon be on his way."
"Days."
"Don't be like that," she said. "Do you have any idea what it took to intercept an FSB confidential communique and substitute our own, so Vanov was directed to you instead of to Bourne?"
"Who better than me, Irina?"
The man posing as Bourne already felt a stirring in his groin.
"Still, what am I to do here?"
"I know how deeply you despise Frankfurt, Jason."
"I love when you call me Jason."
"I'll bet you do,"
Irina chuckled.
"You're too fucking tense. Find something to relax yourself."
"You,"
he said, almost wistfully.
"Only you."
"Come, come, my animal," she whispered. "Surely you can—"
She must have heard his groan, though he thought it was barely audible.
"What are you doing, Jason?"
"You know what I'm doing."
His zipper was open, his right hand rubbing his arousal.
"Relaxing."
"Then, by all means," Irina cooed, "allow me to assist you."
Afterward, he wiped down the window pane with a damp washcloth. Then, changing into the plush, terry robe and slippers provided, he padded down the hallway, taking the elevator to the spa, where he stood under the rainforest shower for 20 minutes, cleansing both his body and his mind. Upstairs in his room, he put on new clothes, went out, and, under a sky burdened with gunmetal clouds, had a too-rich lunch at a cafe in Romerburg, then visited the Imperial Cathedral and St. Paul's Church. The following day he spent at the Zoological Garden, staring down a male lion who smelled like death. Bourne detested zoos, even more than he hated Frankfurt and Germans in general. The thought of caging such magnificent creatures seemed to him a sin deserving of eternal damnation. If he had believed in such a thing, which, as a pragmatist and an atheist, he didn't. "Thank the gods and demons," Irina called the next day.
"He just landed," she said. "He should be at the hotel in an hour."
The morning had dawned gray and ugly, just like the ones before it. Except worse,
It was raining. This city could drive me mad, he thought, as he broke the connection. But that was all done with now. At last, excitement coursed through his veins. It was showtime. Captain Maxim Vanov, FSB, using the temporary title of cultural attaché, arrived at the hotel in a kind of controlled frenzy. It was his first time in Germany, Russia's longtime enemy. His grandfather had fought and died in the great patriotic siege of Stalingrad. He had been taught never to forget. As the bellman opened the door to his room at the Royal Brauweiser, he shrugged the rain off his trench coat. The bellman hung it in the closet, explained the room's amenities, then loitered around until Vanov pressed a few euros into his damp palm. Vanov took out the ancient bronze coin he had worn around his neck since General Karpov himself had given it to him, fingered it until it grew warm from his hand. Then reluctantly, he let it go. Unable to wait a moment more, he picked up the phone, asked for Jason Bourne.
Is he in?
Vanov said, in decent German.
I believe Herr Bourne is taking breakfast in his room this morning. Who, shall I say, is inquiring?
Don't say a word,
Vanov said.
I'm an old friend, and I want to surprise him.
The eager tone in Vanov's voice must have persuaded the man at the front desk. He said,
As you wish, Herr Vanov. Good day.
Good day to you,
Vanov replied in the formal style so beloved of Germans. Then he went out, riding the elevator up to the top floor. It was only when he stood before the door to Jason Bourne's suite that he hesitated, unaccountably gripped by an uncharacteristic bout of anxiety. General Karpov had handpicked him for this most secret and important mission. Having come under the great general's scrutiny, he did not want to fuck up. Everything must go precisely as the general had outlined it. The door opened to his tentative knock, and there he was, Jason Bourne in the flesh. He was dressed in a polo shirt, jeans, and loafers without socks. The physique, the face, were more or less as they had been described to him.
Jason,
he said carefully,
I work with your old friend Boris.
This is how the general had instructed him to begin. Bourne frowned.
Boris. Karpov,
Vanov said.
Boris Karpov. Ah, well, come in.
Bourne gestured to a sideboard.
A drink?
Vanov raised a hand, palm outward.
Not today. And you are?
Captain Vanov.
Vanov glanced around the room, looking for signs of another inhabitant, a woman perhaps, but didn't see any.
We have important matters to discuss.
Indeed, Bourne raised his eyebrows.
By all means.
He moved toward the sofa in the suite's living area.
Shall we make ourselves comfortable? I'd rather stand, if it's all the same to you.
Bourne threw him a curious look, but nodded.
Whatever you say, Captain.
He returned to where Vanov stood.
Why didn't Boris come himself?
Vanov laughed.
Surely you're joking. Preparations for his wedding.
Bourne silently cursed his lapse. Vanov pulled out the bronze coin on its chain, so Bourne could see it.
The general sent me to give you this.
Reaching around behind his neck, he unlocked the chain, dropped it and the coin into Bourne's open hand.
He said you'd understand.
Bourne's expression was rueful.
I'm afraid I don't.
He looked up at Vanov.
Why don't you explain it to me?
Vanov opened his mouth to reply, but almost immediately shut it again. There was something wrong here. Something he had felt almost from the moment Bourne had opened the door. What was it?
Vanov?
Bourne was moving toward him.
Is something wrong? You look like someone just stepped on your grave.
Ничего. Я просто чувствовал холод.
Vanov said. It's nothing, I just felt a chill.
Prosteti, menya za tucho, itak govoru,
Born replied without missing a beat.
No eto, me, meloce.
Pardon me for saying, but that didn't seem like nothing. Vanov stepped back abruptly, bumping into the end of the sofa.
You're not Jason Bourne, he said.
The general briefed me. Bourne's accent is pure Moscow. Yours is
Chertanovo.
Bourne's smile widened.
I've spent more time in Moscow's slums, including Chertanovo, over the intervening years, Captain. Of course, my accent has changed.
Vanov was shaking his head.
You cannot fool me, whoever you are.
He made to grab the coin out of Bourne's hand, but Bourne was ready. He slammed his knuckles into Vanov's throat. Choking, Vanov fell, his hands clutching at his throat. His eyes watered as he tried to gasp for air. Bourne hunkered down in front of him.
I'm not going to waste time debating whether or not I'm the general's old friend, Jason Bourne.
His fist unfurled to reveal the coin. Vanov kicked out, caught Bourne on the inside of his knee, bringing him down. Vanov managed to strike him three times with the edge of his hand, making Bourne's eyes water, before Bourne drew a steel baton out of a holster at his waist, snapped it against the back of Vanov's right hand, fracturing it. Then he struck Vanov a softer blow on the side of his head.
Please, he said. Let's not make this more unpleasant than it already is.
He touched the coin with the tips of his fingers.
Now, tell me about this and the message you were told to give Bourne.
Vanov spat a gob of blood onto Bourne's shirt.
I'm not telling you a thing.
Bourne sighed.
Sorry, Captain.
His hand reached out in a blur, grabbed Vanov by his shirt front, and hauled him to his feet as he himself stood.
I'm afraid we're going to have to do this the unpleasant way. Unpleasant for you, I mean.
He grinned.
Fun for me.
He half-dragged a stumbling Vanov through the suite into the tiled bathroom. Without warning, he struck Vanov on the cheekbone, the baton opening a bloody line. Vanov staggered backward. Bourne caught him, stood him upright, and struck him again in precisely the same place. A bright red spray issued forth as the cut penetrated to the bone.
You see how it is, Captain,
Bourne said.
In here, with all this tile, it's so easy to clean off the blood.
His smile turned sinister.
And unless you answer my questions, there's so much more to come.
He struck Vanov again and again, and the tiles ran red. Bourne sat on the edge of the bathtub, staring down at the thing that had been FSB Captain Vanov. He rose, crossed to the sink, washed his hands, and dried them.
How did it go?
Irina asked when he reached her on his mobile.
Bad news,
he answered.
There was no message, per se.
I don't understand.
Irina's voice was no longer a purr.
Instead, I have a coin.
A coin?
Her tone had turned dark, ominous.
That's it. The message was a coin. Old, ancient, maybe.
And what did he tell you the coin means?
He didn't. He wouldn't talk.
Not a word.
He's a fucking FSB captain, Bourne said, trained to withstand interrogation.
She sighed.
Plan B, then. You'll have to give the coin to Bourne and sell me to him.
No problem.
Don't get cocky, she warned.
I'm only cocky with you.
Listen to me,
мой голодный зверь,
my hungry animal.
If you underestimate Bourne even a little bit, he'll tear you limb from limb, and that will make me very unhappy.
We can't have that,
he said.
I couldn't bear it.
Ringing off, he went to the door sill of the bathroom, removed his blood-spattered loafers, and padded back through the suite to the bedroom. He snapped open one of the three large suitcases, removed an electric rotary saw with an extra-long cord, rolls of thick plastic and duct tape, and a pair of shears. He returned with his haul to the bathroom. Stepping back into his loafers, he crossed to the bathtub and spread one of the rolls of plastic over the drain in the tub and the area of the floor closest to the tub. Navigating to a music app on his mobile, he activated the streaming service. Music flooded the bathroom. He turned up the volume. He plugged the saw into the wall outlet, set the shark-tooth blade against Vanov's right shoulder, and watched it cut a bloody path through skin, viscera, muscle, and bone. 20 minutes later, he had all the pieces of Vanov's corpse wrapped in sections of the plastic and sealed securely with the duct tape. He had saved the decapitated head for last, staring into the eyes, wondering what they had seen at the moment of death. He popped it into a smaller length of plastic, sealed it up. Then he spent another 40 minutes sterilizing the bathroom of any trace of blood, bits of bone, and DNA, using chemicals he'd packed along with the saw, plastic, and tape. Humming to the music from his mobile, he filled the now empty suitcase with as many pieces of the body as would fit. The overflow went into the second suitcase. Then he stripped naked, lay down on the bed, and took a nap. Precisely an hour later, he woke, rose, crossed to the dresser, and ate every single item on the platter of food Herr Hommel had sent up. Fastidiously wiping his fingertips and his glistening lips, he opened the third suitcase, which was filled with what seemed to be an entire wardrobe of clothes. He needed to pick out an outfit that most resembled the one Vanov had worn. 90 minutes after that, he called for the porter, accompanied him down in the elevator with the three shining suitcases. He was checked out by Herr Hommel himself.
The man who had been Jason Bourne and was now Maxim Vanov, unbeknownst to the hotel's executive director, made sure he thanked Herr Hommel for his generous, welcoming gift.
Fantastisch! Much appreciated, mein Herr, he said, as he took back the credit card in the name of Jason Bourne.
Herr Hommel, beaming, all but clicked his heels in delight.
I and all the staff are already looking forward to your next visit, Herr Bourne.
He exited the Royal Brauweiser, his three bags wheeled behind him like ducklings all in a row. With the suitcases neatly stowed in the boot of his rental car, he handed the porter and the valet each generous tips, slid behind the wheel, and drove off. On the outskirts of the city, he stopped at the edge of a deserted lake Irina had previously scoped out, into which he rolled the two suitcases containing the remains of the real Captain Vanov. They disappeared in tiny bursts of bubbles, like a child playing underwater. Then he dried off his feet and shins, pulled on his socks, rolled down his trousers, and laced up his shoes. He drove back into the city, arriving just after 7 p.m., at the Meisterstock Hotel in Stresemanali. He entered as Maxim Vanov, cultural attaché. It was not yet dinner time in Frankfurt, and when he knocked on the door to the room at the end of the third floor, Jason Bourne was still there, packing for his flight to Moscow.
Jason, he said, when the door swung open, I've been sent by Boris.
Bourne frowned.
Boris. Karpov. Boris Karpov. Your old friend. I don't know who you are.
Bourne stood in the doorway, blocking Vanov's way.
Maxim Vanov, Captain FSB, at your service.
Still, Bourne hesitated.
I've been sent by a friend. May I come in?
Vanov's murderer said in Russian.
The matter is urgent, and talking like this in the hallway isn't... Дерхитсе ваши руки. Где я могу видеть их?
Keep your hands where I can see them. Vanov lifted his hands, palms outward. Bourne stepped aside and allowed him in.
И ваш русский язык превосходен, мен говорили.
Your Russian is excellent, as I was told.
Я имел превосходное проповедтели,
Bourne replied. I had excellent teachers. Bourne stood silent, observing Vanov in such a studied, intense fashion that the person beneath the Vanov identity actually felt slightly unnerved. If he were to be honest with himself, he hadn't felt that watery sensation in the pit of his stomach since the time he'd been jumped in a back alley of Chertanovo. He'd just celebrated his 13th birthday by drinking himself half-blind on 180-proof Slivovitz. Five punks had surrounded him, deriding him in Fenya, the language of Russian prisons. They used the slurs like weapons as they herded him into a cul-de-sac, and their leader began the beatdown. He was carrying little money and no items of value, such as a watch or a ring. Infuriated, they surely would have killed him if Irina hadn't interceded. She shot the leader dead with an old Makarov she had somehow managed to purchase on the black market, despite her tender age. How she had managed this, he could not imagine. In any event, the dead punk's compatriots vanished like yesterday's newspapers. That was the precise moment when he had seen her applying her trade for real, that he knew he loved her more than he would love anyone else during his lifetime. Bourne, glancing at his wristwatch, said, "Time, Captain. I leave for the airport in less than an hour."
"Then my timing couldn't be more perfect," Vanov said,
brushing aside his brief upsurge of memory. Irina could do that to him, often at the most inopportune moments. He couldn't stop it. He was helpless to control anything about her, even his own memories, as if part of her had lodged itself inside him just before the moment of their separation in their mother's womb. Vanov produced the bronze coin, holding it out in the palm of his hand.
"Does this knock out any cobwebs?"
Bourne stared at the coin for a moment before looking up to study Captain Vanov's face with every ounce of his experience and skills. Boris had told him Vanov would be coming to see him when he had called to invite Bourne to his wedding.
"You don't seem happy for me, my friend," he'd said.
"Happy enough," Bourne replied. "I'm just wondering about the rush. I've never heard you mention Svetlana before."
"Love comes to all of us, my friend, if we're lucky. Even you, Jason. Even you."
Bourne had momentarily stiffened, wondering if Boris, with all his tentacled sources, knew about Sarah. But how could he? He'd met her, of course, but that was before there had been anything between her and Bourne. Still, when it came to love, Bourne found it imperative to be paranoid. He had vowed never to put Sarah in more danger than she was used to, even if that meant walking away from her and his feelings for her. He'd done it before. He'd do it again. On the other hand, he was becoming aware of the increasing difficulty in cutting off his feelings at the knees, and this, a weakness for someone in his line of work, was cause for concern.
"Don't worry," Boris had continued. "I know you're on your way to Moscow anyway. Are you any closer to finding Ivan Bors?"
When it comes to Bors, closer is a relative term.
"But you will find him."
It hadn't been a question. Boris never questioned Bourne's abilities. "Yes.
Just to make sure you kill him this time. The son of a bitch has a knack for cheating death almost as often as you do. He's so slippery, so full of changes in identity. If I didn't know better, I'd think you tutored him."
"Now, that would present a problem."
"I'm sending Ivanov with something for you."
The darkening of Boris's voice had alerted Bourne that they had entered the real reason for the call.
"Keep it safe, at all costs."
"What is it?"
"A lifeline."
"What?"
"A lifeline for the end of the world."
And with that cryptic comment, Boris had rung off. Now, in the hotel room in Frankfurt, Bourne took the coin at last. Boris's lifeline. He turned it, looking at it from all angles. Clearly it's ancient,
from the Roman Empire. Other than that,
he glanced up at Vanov, shook his head. Vanov looked crestfallen, an emotion that was genuine.
Oh, pity. The general instructed me to bring it to you. He said that you would know what it means.
Born nodded noncommittally. There was no verbal or written message with it, Born asked.
There will be many people you don't know at the wedding. Some may know you, and not be pleased to see you. I'm to set you up with someone who will be of use to you in this and other matters. She will help in whatever you may require.
Captain Vanov handed Born a slip of paper.
Here is her mobile number. When you land at Sheremetyevo, call her.
Born frowned.
Who is this Wonder Woman? Her name is Irina. Irina Vasilevna. She's very well connected in many of Moscow's influential Siloviki and oligarch circles. She's also conversant with other, how shall I put it, unofficial personnel.
She's into Moscow's black market?
Her father and brother were. They're dead.
Vanov nodded.
3 years now.
Strange, he thought, how speaking of his own father's and brother's deaths meant nothing to him. It was as if he were speaking of fictional characters, or ones who had never existed. Of course, it was different for Irina. She and their father had been very close. Their father had confided everything in her. And for this, he had been supremely grateful.
I won't need her, Born said. The general insists his wedding run perfectly smoothly. These are his explicit orders.
With an obsequious smile, Vanov moved toward the door. With his hand on the doorknob, he turned.
Good luck, Mr. Born. I trust you've brought a heavy overcoat. In Moscow, you will hear winter's footsteps hard on your heels.
Part 1.
Of all the aphrodisiacs in the world, the most powerful is being a twin. Irina Vasilevna.
1.
My bear, where have you been?
Svetlana asked.
Working, my pet,
General Boris Karpov said as he came out of the enormous bathroom of their palatial Moscow hotel suite.
Working,
Svetlana evinced an exaggerated pout.
On this day of all days.
Karpov sighed as he plucked his freshly pressed dress uniform jacket off the wooden caddy.
Unfortunately, the world doesn't stop to celebrate our wedding.
Svetlana Novichenko had a face like a porcelain doll. A porcelain doll with killer cheekbones, emerald eyes, and hair the color of champagne. That she was half Ukrainian rather than full Russian was no impediment to Boris Karpov marrying her. He was the head of the combined FSB and FSB-2, the inheritors of the KGB, the president's infamous alma mater. As such, he was in a highly privileged position in the Russian Federation, medaled, feted at the Kremlin, invited to every glittering political affair, surrounded by the Tsar's jewel box interiors. He'd even had dinner once or twice with the president himself. All this was to say that Boris Karpov could marry whomever he wanted, so long as she wasn't a Jew. Svetlana Novichenko wasn't a Jew. She was a member of a wealthy and powerful mixed Russian and Ukrainian industrial family that traced its lineage back to Tsar Nicholas I.
What were you really doing, Boris?
She was stretched out now on a velvet chaise longue, her slim, magnificent body naked and glistening. Her arms were raised over her head in a provocative pose, deliberately mimicking Francisco Goya's La Maja Desnuda.
If you must know,
Boris said, fastening the brass buttons of his jacket with its six rows of medals emblazoned across its left breast.
Cairo Station was in a bit of a muddle, having discovered the Israelis had been spying on them electronically.
Cairo is so far from where we are, here in the bosom of Mother Russia.
He gave her a sideways glance.
I rarely know when you're being facetious.
Oh, yes you do, darling.
Svetlana smiled with her small, white teeth.
You simply won't admit it.
She extended her arms over her head even farther, throwing her breasts into high relief.
You sure you're not carrying out yet another stage in the sovereign's pernicious campaign against Ukraine?
Boris frowned, trying his best to ignore her attempt at seduction.
You don't believe me.
The sovereign seems to have bent all his energies on reclaiming what Russia has lost over the years. Aren't you part of that?
Don't be absurd.
Do you not credit what he just stated publicly?
He makes many statements, Lana.
This one is more despicable than the others. Last night, he defended the treaty the Soviet Union signed with Nazi Germany on the eve of the World War II, under which they secretly carved up Poland and other countries like the butchers they were. The sovereign is no better than Molotov and Ribbentrop. Proof positive, he's a madman.
Boris said nothing. He was irrationally resentful that she had exponentially expanded the knot of anxiety in his stomach that for weeks he had been trying to control. And on their wedding night.
And what has this war stance gotten him? Privation here at home for the populace? As Western embargoes cut deep, the ruble is at an all-time low, and the stock market is in freefall. Even the billionaires' concerns grow daily as they see their money hoards receding like the tide. Face it, the sovereign is in trouble. He's shoved the entire Federation onto a slippery slope.
What slippery slope are you referring to?
Though Boris knew all too well to what she was referring. Svetlana sighed, which only served to thrust her breasts out even more.
Vankor, she said,
with that canny look in her eye that had made Boris fall in love with her.
What about it?
He felt a stab of fear rush through him. Her combination of intelligence and uncanny intuition was bringing her far too close to the nub of the matter.
My bear, do you think I don't know how the sovereign has severely altered the Federation energy strategy? Russia owns the oil-rich Vankor fields free and clear. Through Vankorneft, it has the expertise and the infrastructure to run it. And yet, the sovereign has just struck a secret deal with the Chinese, allowing them to buy 10% of Vankorneft.
She eyed Boris.
Why on earth would the sovereign chip off a piece of one of the Federation's crown jewels?
Boris said nothing, knowing she liked to answer her own questions.
Because, my bear, the sovereign is frantic for money. The economy is deteriorating at an alarming rate. It takes billions to keep an army on the ground away from home. Mother Russia has to feed all those breakaway rebels in eastern Ukraine, not to mention subsidize all of Crimea now. And with the ruble in freefall, the stock market so depressed that yesterday Apple's net worth exceeded that of our entire market. Where is the money coming from? Desperate times call for desperate measures. And you, caught in the middle. This is what worries me the most.
Svetlana misinterpreted his pained expression.
My bear,
You are programmed to lie. Even to me. I might say, especially to me.
He turned to face her.
And why would that be?
Your important business. On your wedding day. Wouldn't happen to be Maskirovka?
Karpov laughed. There were times, like now, when her intelligence and intuition truly frightened him.
My entire adult life, I've been spinning webs of concealment, plausible deniability, and carefully leaked desinformatia, designed to confuse, befuddle, and lead astray our enemies, so that they cannot predict what we will do next, let alone be able to respond to it.
Svetlana's arms came down as she sat up straighter.
You know, there are some who claim you're wanting to marry me is nothing more than Maskirovka.
What?
Because of my family.
He stared at her, as if he'd suddenly found a viper in his room.
That you don't really love me. That you have agreed to enter into a marriage of convenience.
Hey,
Boris laughed again. But it was all sharp edges, nothing amused about it.
I have the ear of the president. I don't need your family.
But seeing the serious look on her face, he sobered quickly. His face clouded over.
Who?
He said.
Who would be passing such disgusting desinformatia?
If you knew, would you cut out his tongue?
Boris grunted.
I'm not medieval. I'm not Ivan the Terrible.
Also up for debate.
Boris's heavy eyebrows lifted.
Who is feeding you such nonsense?
You know perfectly well who. First Minister Timur Savasin. But don't worry, my love. If I believed a word of it, do you think I'd be marrying you?
But now Boris looked truly unhappy.
It's true. You have the ear of the sovereign. But if his right-hand man is passing lies, I can't believe the sovereign isn't aware of it. You have to admit, the sovereign is a piece of work, adoring his Hemingway, going hunting, riding around half-naked on a horse.
He longs only to repair what was sundered decades ago. He wants the repatriation of the countries that were part of the Soviet Union.
Countries whose faltering economies put such a strain on Moscow. It was forced to let them go. Good riddance, I say.
The Russian Federation is too small for this new world order, Svetlana. We need to spread our wings once more.
Now you sound like Hitler.
Bite your tongue. The president wants only what was once his. And so do all the Russians. His popularity is soaring.
What was once his? Do you even hear yourself? Ukraine, Lithuania, Poland, Latvia, Estonia, and all the rest were occupied by Russian troops at the end of World War II. They never belonged to Moscow. And they sure as hell don't belong to the sovereign, the Tsar Batyushka.
I wish you wouldn't call him that.
Why not? I'm not the one who traffics in lies and deceit.
If I thought you had a Ukrainian heart.
Svetlana's flush had crept from her cheeks to her throat and the tops of her shoulders.
You do what? Dispatch one of your hooded terrorists to kill me? Order one of your tanks idling at the border to run me over? Or arrange this very marriage? After all, takeover by proxy is the sovereign's latest methodology for waging war.
He rolled his eyes.
There is no use talking to you and...
I hate it when you treat me like a child, Boris Ilyich.
He knew she was really angry. She almost never called him by his patronymic. Nevertheless, he couldn't help himself.
If you act like a child, you'll be treated as such. You're jumping at phantoms, letting your imagination run away with you. That's the Russian definition of paranoia, you know.
His voice turned abruptly conciliatory. All self-defensive barbs retracted.
My field of expertise is the Middle East, as you very well know. As for Ukraine and the other countries of the former Soviet bloc, and yet you question my loyalty.
I did no such thing. Our discussion...
Is that what this is?
Once again, he stood watching her.
Our discussion was purely hypothetical.
This is all about economics, isn't it?
She continued, off on another tack now that she had made her point. The economics of greed.
The sovereign and his Siloviki made billions of dollars on Russia's oil. But now that's all coming to an end. From where will the money come to keep the Federation going? That uncertainty, that fear, has given birth to all this talk of repatriation. Russia now needs the former Soviet countries in order to remain
strong.
But in the past, they brought Mother Russia to the brink of insolvency.
Boris once again marveled at this woman's grasp of the tangled threads of economics and geopolitics. It was one of the reasons he fell in love with her, though her prowess in bed was indescribable. She was right, all the way down the line. Privately, he thought the president's goal was one that would certainly bankrupt Russia. The satellites had to be let go. They had been dragging Moscow into insolvency. The USSR had been too vast, too unwieldy. And now, with Chechen and other Muslim ethnics feeling they were owed the world, this was not the time to try to corral them back into the pen. Those horses had left forever.
But you see how wrong you are, Lana. The president has already announced a pact with Ukraine to keep the natural gas spigot open through the long cold winter that will be upon us in months.
She shook her head.
You think? I don't know what the sovereign is planning, Boris. But I do. Russians don't want war. They don't want him. Already the Western sanctions are strangling us. And it's the men and women in the streets who are suffering. That so-called pact with Ukraine will fall apart before it is even signed. The sovereign will blame NATO for tampering with Ukraine. The temperature has already plummeted. As the winter arrives, he will turn off the natural gas spigot, not only to Ukraine, but to all of Western Europe, triggering a recession that will race around the world.
Boris barked a mirthless laugh, his expression darkening.
What an imagination you have, my pet. The president won't risk starting World War III. He may be crazy, but he's not insane.
She laughed.
Of course, you're right. I got carried away. Oh, come on, darling, don't pout. It makes you look like a willful child.
Even at low wattage, her smile was irresistible.
Besides, you'd never have fallen for someone who wasn't this spirited.
Her smile widened as she beckoned him with her crooked finger, its tip lacquered blood red.
Come here, my bear. You look so handsome in your dress grays.
Boris shook his head. He still appeared put out by their friendly argument, even though verbal sparring was a staple of their relationship.
No fucking until after the ceremony.
Who said anything about fucking?
Svetlana said, with a seductive smirk.
Later.
Staring into her eyes, he straightened his jacket by pulling down on the hem with both hands.
As much as we both want, but later.
Boris, you're so bourgeois.
No, my love. Merely practical.
He came and bent over, kissed her lightly on the lips.
Now it is time for you to bathe or apply makeup or do whatever it is you females do to get ready.
Idiot!
But her smile was warm as she kissed him back, more passionately, her soft lips opening as her hand went behind his head.
Now go,
she said, releasing him in her mock command voice.
Mingle with our guests.
And as he crossed the room,
and be nice.
I'm always nice,
Boris said. Her throaty laughter followed him out the door. The moment the door closed, Svetlana wrapped herself in a royal-looking, floor-length silk robe. Veniamin Belov entered from a narrow door that connected to the next room. He was a small man with pale skin, thick black hair, and round-lensed glasses behind which were dark, restless eyes that seemed to constantly be looking for a safe exit. He held a small device in front of him, waving it back and forth, searching for electronic bugs. When he was satisfied there were none, he came toward Svetlana.
So, he said, has he declared himself one way or another?
Svetlana's mouth twitched.
Veniamin Nazarovich. You mean you didn't have a stethoscope pressed to the door?
Belov's tense lips twitched in reply.
This isn't a game, Juana. How many times must I tell you? Come here, love, she said, her arms reaching out. Your tie is too tight.
He shook his head.
Don't make me regret.
What?
Her eyes flashed a warning.
This plan would be a non-starter if it weren't for me.
He remained silent for a time, as if trying to reset the temperature in the room, which had turned decidedly frosty. At length, he sighed.
All apologies, Lana. Perhaps my impatience
is showing like a slip beneath a skirt,
she cut in curtly,
and is just as careless.
Mea culpa,
he laced his fingers.
Mea maxima culpa.
This produced a smile from her, and though small, managed to raise the temperature of the room.
With such fluency, you could infiltrate the Vatican hierarchy with ease.
Belov relaxed, visibly.
Your assessment of the general's state of mind, then?
Svetlana frowned.
Frankly, I don't know. With Boris, facts are in short supply, always.
She wet her lips.
He evinces the sovereign's line, even here with me, in private.
Disappointing. He has the reputation for being his own man.
However,
Svetlana raised a forefinger,
were I to hazard a guess, I would be willing to bet that his personal opinions are the polar opposite.
Aligned with ours, in other words.
Belov tapped a long, narrow finger against his lower lip.
How much would you be willing to bet on the general?
What do you imagine?
She shrugged her shapely shoulders.
I'm all in.
Something in her tone must have struck a chord inside him.
Lana, please don't tell me you've fallen in love with him.
That's none of your business,
she said, a shade too quickly.
Oh, but it is.
He perched on the edge of the sofa cushion nearest her.
Love has a way of distorting reality. I know you understand this. We've been through it with other people. You've seen the failures caused by the distortions. We are all counting on you. You're the straw that stirs the drink. In the 11th hour, where we find ourselves, you cannot afford to make a mistake.
Svetlana drew herself up.
And now, in the 11th hour, have you lost faith in me, Veniamin Nazarovich?
That was a gut check.
Nothing wrong with my guts.
Good.
Belov rose.
Because without the general.
Don't say it, she admonished, unfurling off the sofa at last.
Don't you dare even think it.
2. Boris strode along the tapestried hallway, through thrown-open double doors, army and FSB guards on either side, into the glittering ballroom, mobbed with people in fancy dress. He felt a wild surge of pride. They were all here. The president, the first minister, the prime minister, the head of the presidential administration, the first chief of staff, the foreign secretary, and so many others. They were all here to honor him on his day of marriage. Champagne and caviar were flowing, along with copious shots of the finest triple-filtered vodka, passed around on silver trays by uniformed waiters. In one corner, a string quartet was playing a transliteration of a Tchaikovsky symphony that, to his ears, sounded strained and ridiculous. But in all the seething ocean of Kremlin hierarchy and elite members of the oligarchic nomenklatura, the men who feasted off the Federation's economy, the one person he searched for and found was his old friend and comrade in arms, Jason Bourne. As he waded through the hand clasps, the shoulder grips, the murmured words of congratulations, the barely hidden looks of jealousy, and yes, fear. For he was a feared man within the Federation, as well as in far-flung climes. He was surprised to see that Bourne wasn't alone. By his side was a small, slender, cat-like woman in a deep purple dress whose bodice was slit so far down that the inner halves of her heavy, globular breasts were visible in a most inflammatory manner. Boris flattered himself that he knew Bourne as well as anyone on the planet, which was not to say in any way completely. No one did. Not even Bourne himself, Boris surmised, not since his memory loss. But one thing he was sure of was that Bourne was the quintessential loner. He never had a woman on his arm. Yet the way this handsome woman had wrapped her arm possessively around his, it didn't look as if she was about to let him go anytime soon. Even more oddly, Bourne didn't seem to notice. He moved as if she were not there at all. An enigma, to be sure, Boris thought pensively, that he must ask Bourne about after the ceremony, when they could slip out for a quiet, unsurveilled talk. He felt a measure of shame that he had an ulterior motive when he had extended the wedding invitation to Bourne. Wouldn't life be nice, he thought, if the only reason he wanted Bourne here was to celebrate the marriage? Nice, perhaps, he reflected. But that was someone else's life, not his. Then, as he moved closer, his heart skipped a beat. Was that? Could it be? And then the thought exploded behind his eyes. What the hell was Jason Bourne doing with Irina Vasilievna? It didn't seem possible that the two of them could know each other. And if they did, why hadn't Jason mentioned it? Surely he knew. Boris's eyes became slits. But the way he was acting, Boris was almost certain he didn't know. Irina's father, Vasily, had been a wealthy and powerful oligarch. But even the wealthy and powerful could run into serious trouble if they were in business with the wrong people. This was what had happened to Vasily and his older son, his firstborn. Boris had not ordered the dual termination. He'd been in Damascus with Jason, as their interests had intersected. The order, so he had been told subsequently, had come from the president himself. He returned in time to save the twins from the same fate, arguing truthfully that, unlike the firstborn, they could not be blamed for Vasily's crimes. Of course, the twins never knew how close they had come to death or who had saved them. But their grandfather did, and he had been grateful. Now, with a titanic effort of will, Boris broke out in a broad smile as the two men embraced one another, not only as old friends, but also as brothers who had shared peril after peril, who had saved each other's life not once, but numerous times. This was the world in which they both lived, and the embrace was to acknowledge their mutual survival to see this momentous day dawn. At least this much is genuine, Boris thought. He kissed Born on each cheek, and when he did so on the cheek away from the woman at his side, he whispered in his ear,
"You received the coin in good order."
Born gave a slight nod.
"Good. We have urgent matters to discuss. Meet me at the far end of the Hotel Loggia directly after the appetizer is served."
As an added measure of security, he had spoken in Arabic, a tongue they both knew well. The moment of intimacy over, he pulled back, and with an official smile now plastered on his face, moved off to a flurry of handshakes and well wishes from knots of guests clamoring to congratulate him. Though Born was acutely uncomfortable with Irina clinging to him, no one, not even his friend Boris Karpov, and certainly not Irina herself, was aware of his inner turmoil. She exuded sex the way other people gave off body odor. She smelled as if she had just had sex or was inflamed by it. It was a constant strain to keep his mind clear. He had called her after he had cleared customs and immigration at Sheremetyevo. She had offered to send a car for him, but Born was not in the habit of climbing into cars sent for him. He gave her an address where he'd meet her in the city center and took a taxi in past the Garden Ring Road. She had smiled when she saw him, a megaton smile as heavy as it was wide. "Good evening," she'd said in Moscow-accented Russian, and kissed him on both cheeks, just as if they were old friends. "Your flight was acceptable, I trust." "It was fine," Born had said, getting his first exposure to her heady musk. She saw his nostrils flare, and the answering curl of her lips told him all he needed to know about her self-awareness.
"Captain Vanov described you perfectly," she had said, taking his arm in the possessive way she had.
Born did not trust her, much as he hadn't fully trusted Vanov. For one thing, Boris had never mentioned this woman, would not have had someone waiting for him. Knowing Born's preference for being alone, he was out of character. On the other hand, Vanov had given him Boris's coin, so right away he was confronted by an anomaly that only Boris could clear up. In the meantime, it seemed best to allow the string to play out with Irina, to see what she really wanted from him. There were so many cross currents, political as well as business, in Moscow, more treacherous than anything in Washington. It was easy to lose your way and find yourself entangled in a web of someone else's making. This possibility seemed magnified to him as Boris had chosen this moment of his marriage to send Born a mysterious coin and refer to it as his lifeline. Born drank in the sight of Irina. She wore a flared coat in deep red, high black boots, spit-shined, high-heeled. Her hair, loose and dark, framed a face that seemed made to kiss. He felt the press of her breast as she walked with him through the reddish-green Moscow night, filled with flashing lights and the roving eyes of members of every state agency imaginable. A black Land Rover 5.0 LSUV was waiting for them two blocks away, idling at the curb, its enormous 510-horsepower V8 engine panting like a lion after a kill.
A uniformed chauffeur opened the rear door as they approached.
The uniform was unfamiliar to Born. It was certainly not from any official government agency. He must be employed by a private company then, or an extremely wealthy oligarch. The SUV cut its way through the heavy traffic, heading out of the heart of the city. The driver took an exit on the north side, onto an impeccably maintained road, something of a novelty in Moscow, lined with flowering cherry trees. Up ahead was a dense pine forest into which the road plunged as if into a mountain tunnel. The SUV's headlights split the otherwise impenetrable darkness, picking out a blur of needles and upthrust branches. Not even the star-strewn sky was visible. Just as abruptly, they emerged from the forest. The headlights picked out a glossy green wall at least 20 feet high. As the vehicle slowed, electronic gates opened, then closed behind it. Before them was another world, entirely separate from the rest of Russia, in which enormous gilded mansions sprawled over gracious estate grounds. Some looked Victorian, others Georgian, Japanese, Art Deco. There was even a mansion built like a Bavarian castle. They passed all these over-the-top residences, turned into a long driveway composed of white marble chips that glittered like stars in the headlights. On the way, they passed a pair of great stone sphinxes amid the exquisitely manicured gardens, their enigmatic smiles exactly duplicating the Egyptian originals. The mansion, lit up as if for a holiday, was in the Art Nouveau style, ornate stone facade, sculpted female faces crowning windows that looked like eyes, hemispheric balconies iced with swirling verdigris copper railings that seemed to be melting like something out of a Dalí painting or a drug-fueled fever dream.
32,000 square feet, indoor pool and ice skating rink, two movie theaters, a ballroom.
Irina had said it as if reciting a multiplication table.
What else? At the moment, I can't remember.
The SUV rolled to a stop opposite the front door. She had turned to him, smiling.
Home.
Now, as the crowd made its slow march into the ballroom where the marriage ceremony would take place, Bourne was put in mind of a Financial Times article he had read on the flight over. Not only were there more billionaires living in Moscow than in any other city on Earth, but fully one-third of the Federation's economy was owned and controlled by just 36 men, all of whom stood in the shadow of one man, the president. The concentration of wealth was one of the main reasons dealing with anyone with power in Moscow was so treacherous. Their enemies instantly became your enemies. They paraded between two lines of guards, grim-faced and certainly armed despite the festive occasion. They scrutinized every face that passed them by, save for those who could have their heads with one spoken word. The ballroom was huge. Nevertheless, it was filled to capacity. Pinpoints of light from the ornate chandeliers caused disco fireworks to spark off the luxe jewelry hanging from the women's necks, ears, and wrists, and from the brilliantined hair of their husbands, lovers, and escorts. As the last to enter took their seats, 10 guards moved into the ballroom, ringing the walls, while the remaining 6 kept their stations in the wide, wood-paneled hallway. Bourne had not had to count. His eyes, surveying the immediate environment, had communicated the information, along with a boatload of other trivia, to his brain, to be sorted at lightning speed, filed away, should it be needed. He had done the same with the interior of Irina's mansion, from the marble statue of Michelangelo's David, spewing recycled water from the tip of his penis into a carved alabaster shell 3 feet across, to the antique Isfahan carpet in the study, to the titles of the books on the oiled teak shelves. She had ushered him to a seat on one of twin, hand-stitched Italian leather sofas. A servant entered with a silver serving tray stocked with small plates of caviar and a variety of drinks, from tea to vodka. Everything screamed money, vaults of it. Bourne had a brief but amusing vision of Scrooge McDuck diving into his swimming pool of silver dollars. When they were alone, Bourne said, "Do you live in this place all by yourself?" Irina's smile was both cunning and prurient.
"So Captain Vanoff tells me you don't know why the coin was sent to you," she said, ignoring his question.
"That's right." Bourne noted her reluctance to talk about herself, filed it away for further reflection.
May I see it?
She held out a perfectly manicured hand. She was studying him with the almost obsessive intensity of a lepidopterist.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Instantly, she pouted, using coyness to try and mask her interest.
I simply want to look at it. What harm could that do?
Tell me about this house, Bourne said, a half-smile fixed to his face. She regarded him for a moment from beneath half-closed lids, then shrugged.
As you wish. I respect your need for privacy.
She offered him a small pile of beluga on a tiny blini, balancing it on her fingertip.
I'll talk while we eat.
Her smile turned prurient again.
I don't want to be accused of letting you go to bed hungry.